Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And you're listening to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today with another great author interview, this time with Emiko Jean, the author of Tokyo Ever After, as well as Empress for All Seasons and We'll Never Be Apart. Tokyo Ever After just came out a month ago or 2 months ago. It came out in May and was a book club pick for Reese's Book Club, the book club of Reese Witherspoon. Yeah, we had a great time chatting with her. We've had a lot of really great author interviews these past few weeks. And I got to say, this was a fun, like, you know, before this one, we read a thriller. And it was really great to kind of have a palate cleanser with a nice, like, fluffy rom-com. Is it a rom-com? Kind of like a Princess Diaries.
Oh, yeah. It's a very comedic story with lots of, you know, glitz and glamour. And of course, like, court drama and a little bit of like Mean Girls.
Yeah.
If you've ever watched the movie What a Girl Wants with Amanda Bynes and Colin Firth, you can expect something along those lines.
But and, Asian, which is the best Asian, part about it.
which is great. So for those of you who are unfamiliar with the story of Tokyo Ever After, it tells the story of Izumi Tanaka, who is an all-American It tells the story of Izumi Tanaka, who is a Japanese-American living in a small, mostly white Northern California town. She's raised by a single mother who is a professor of botany, and she has never known her father. But one day, through a series of circumstances, she discovers her father's identity, and he turns out to be none other than the Crown Prince of Japan, which means Izumi is literally a princess. So she finds out a way to connect with her father, and she travels to Japan. And it is a country that she's always dreamed of going, but obviously being a princess isn't all ball gowns and tiaras. There's a lot of expectations and, of course, succession drama, paparazzi, mean conniving cousins, and a really hot bodyguard that might, you know, be her soulmate, you know, the works.
You know, I haven't watched The Princess Diaries until this year when my girlfriend made me watch it with her. But I can see the appeal, and definitely, I think for all of the, you know, Asian American kids who watch that movie kind of wanting to relate, but wanting to relate a little more, I think this story is for them. I want to see the movie version of the story. I think that'd be
cool. Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, I love the idea of modern royalty, and we see it a lot in like European royalty. A lot of books about the American girl who hooks up with the prince and then she has to learn how to deal with the in-laws. So this is a different take on the story, and it's nice to see our own culture and tradition being, you know, the star of the story. And I don't know, I just really like this trope of forgotten princess has to suddenly learn how to be a princess. It's just fun. And
yeah.
I'm really glad that we got to read this. So
yeah, we had a great conversation with Emiko. So without further ado, let's get to the interview. Please enjoy.
And we are here with Emiko Jean, the author of We'll Never Be Apart, Empress of All Seasons, and most recently, Tokyo Ever After. Emiko, so nice to have you on the podcast. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, congratulations on your recent book launch. My girlfriend has already read your book. She read your book before I even had a chance to like receive your book. I think she's very excited that I'm talking to you right now.
So, Emiko, we usually like to ask our authors, like, if they were always a writer, if it's a passion that came later in life. I know that, I was looking at your bio earlier, and it seems like you've juggled a lot of things in your past, life. You were an entomologist, you were a candle maker, you were a teacher. So how did you become a writer?
Yeah, so my road to writing and publication was really windy and long. I'd always been a really voracious reader. I remember getting stacks and stacks of books from the library. My mom would take me there like every weekend, and I would get, you know, back then, I think libraries have limits now, but back then it was as much as you could carry. So I remember like weighing myself down with, books. But I never really saw myself in any of the books that I read. Looking back now, as I'm kind of examining my adolescence, I had never read a book by a Japanese American author or even an Asian American author. And I had never read a book as a young person that featured an Asian American protagonist. And so I think that was really formative, and it closed that pathway. So although I loved reading, I never thought that I could be a writer. I pursued a bunch of odd jobs, like you just said, none of which I was happy at. So like I tried my hand at being like a quote unquote small business owner, which meant that I was trying to be like a florist or a candle maker. I got my master's degree in teaching. My parents were teachers. So I tried that for a little while. I tried on entomology, which I actually really loved, but I ended up loving writing slightly more. So I was really unhappy at the jobs that I was working at. And that's when I started to write my first book. I think for me, at least, when I was kind of in this like really unhappy period in my life, like I was searching for something. And that's why I actually started writing the book, the first book that I ever wrote and cut my teeth on that will never be published because I think it's so bad. I wrote it while I was working, and I would pretend to be sending emails, and I'd be typing chapters into like the body of the email. So I wrote that book, and I tried to get an agent with that first book, and it was during the Twilight craze. And so I wrote something that had like werewolves and like fairies and stuff in it. And anyways, I'm like even embarrassed telling you that I wrote that, but it was kind of what I said, I cut my teeth on it, and I ended up obviously not getting any representation for that. And then I decided to try my hand at a thriller, at a YA thriller. And that's the book that got me representation with my agent, who I'm still with today. But even then, you know, my first book, Will Never Be Apart, was a thriller, and the protagonist was white in it. So I still hadn't kind of reconciled like putting myself in the page or being a Japanese American writer and what that meant. And, I really think subconsciously, I believe that I wouldn't get published if I didn't have a white main character.
So what was the process like for you to like reconcile with that? Because your second book actually is another court drama taking place in an imperial court. And then your third book, it's straight up Japanese American main character. was that a process for you to get comfortable with that? Or was that, how did you come around to like featuring Asian stories?
Yeah. So it was very much an evolution and a self-examination. So I, around that time, there were more and more, this is kind of when the diversity movement and YA literature also kicked off. And I was seeing the emergence of more Asian American writers in the YA space, writing stories with Asian characters. And I decided to write a fantasy mostly because I wanted to study ancient Japan. And I was interested in fantasy. So I kind of merged those two things together. You know, my interest in kind of ancient Japan, and then also my interest in like magical worlds. and that was really purposeful for me when I decided I want to write a book that features, you know, an entire Japanese cast of characters and explores, you know, the myth and folklore of Japan. And I really see it kind of as a building block too to Tokyo Ever After. I mean, if you look at them, you know, as two separate pieces, they really do look quite different. But for me, as like a writer, I did this kind of study of ancient Japan, which I think really prepared me to write this book about, you know, modern Japan.
Yeah. When you started writing more own voices stories, like mm-hmm. how did it feel? Did it feel different?
Yeah, it felt different and empowering. It also felt like I was doing something that was more for me. So it was really fulfilling, but it was also scary at the same time because I wasn't sure, you know, I make my living at being a writer, and that's always kind of in the back of your mind is this book going to sell? Will it find a readership? And so there's always that concern, especially because it was right at that tipping point where, again, like most of publishing, and it still is dominated by white authors and white characters. So, you know, it's kind of scary to be putting yourself out there.
I want to ask, like, because this takes place in modern day Japan with modern day imperial family, mm-hmm. How much research went into it? I know, like, with the British monarchy, there are people who are, like, really into it. Mm-hmm. So are you, like, a big imperial family, Japanese monarchy, I guess, like, otaku, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not a super fan, but I am really interested in them, especially because, you know, in many ways they represent the good and bad of Japan and the culture of Japan. And so I think that's why it was so important that, you know, is there, the way that Tokyo Ever After started was writing about a girl, a Japanese American, searching for her identity, and that placement in the imperial family and that like Princess Diaries trope came secondary to that. And so it was really purposeful that I chose the imperial family because I wanted it to be, you know, the embodiment of Japan.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up like Princess Diaries because that's how yeah. the book was pitched to me. They were like, oh, it's Princess Diaries meet Crazy Rich Asians. And, yeah. you know, yeah. as someone who went to film school, I'm very skeptical when people pitch me with like, this meets this, because usually that is not how the story goes, but it's like an easy shorthand.
It's a very like, convincing pitch. I mean, yeah, my girlfriend, she was like, I'm in because she loves the Princess Diaries.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, I feel like The Princess Diaries is so informative for girls of our generation because, like, everybody dreams of, like, when you're, like, a mediocre person who is caught in between cultures, it's like, I want to, you know, I want to be extraordinary. You find out one day that you're a princess or you're, like, the chosen one. And for us, it's, you know, we didn't grow up seeing Asian American princesses for a lot of like stories where you find like lost princesses or lost chosen ones, they're usually white. So I just really like the fact that this was a familiar story, but with a different face, with my face. And I was just wondering, like, when you were writing this, did you relate to Izumi? Like, was Izumi kind of like a mirror to your own growth as a Japanese American writer?
Yeah, so absolutely. So Izumi is kind of a wish fulfillment for me. And she really goes on a journey that I myself didn't go on until, you know, I'm in my late 30s. So until probably just now, and reconciling my Japanese American identity. It's a journey that I wish I had had much earlier. Growing up, I always felt really bifurcated, and that, you know, I wasn't ever Japanese enough and I wasn't ever American enough. And this was pointed out a lot to me by classmates in society. It took a long time for me to like really consider myself a whole person, with, you know, a unique story, but that I didn't have to live up to kind of like the standards of what it means to be Japanese or what it means to be American.
Going back to like Princess Diaries, like obviously like Mia in that story, like she is pretty much like the opposite of royalty. Like she needs to take these classes. But in your story, Tokyo Ever After, Izumi has the additional challenge of, you know, not knowing the language. And it's on top of like court etiquette, she has to like learn Japanese culture. And, you know, I think that's just like a whole nother layer of like the Asian American experience of mm-hmm. just like, I know where my parents are from, kind mm-hmm. of, but, you know, I don't speak the language. I don't know the culture. It kind of seems like the motherland is almost a fantasy land, because you yeah. are like, you don't really know about it, but you hear about it.
Yeah, there's such an ache to belong somewhere. And there's not an easy answer, because if you go to Japan, you don't fit in, as in, you know, a Japanese American, like it's, you stick out in many ways. I mean, you can blend sometimes, but as soon as you start speaking, or, you know, your mannerisms, all of that, you don't blend. And so unfortunately, there's not, you kind of have to find a home within yourself, if that makes sense. Because even though there is that ache to return to Japan and to be amongst other Japanese people, it is true that, you know, for some, you won't be Japanese enough.
Have you ever been to Japan, just out of curiosity?
I have not. I'm planning on actually going, if everything looks good travel-wise, this next spring with my dad, who's never been either. So we're kind of doing that kind of heritage trip.
I also love that you set Izumi's hometown as like the Mount Shasta area, because I think, mm-hmm. you know, when I first heard, oh, she's from the Northern California, you think Bay Area, which mm-hmm. is pretty diverse, but you set her in Northern California, which is like north of San Francisco and Sacramento, which is basically Oregon at that point. And it's, you know, yeah. it's probably one of the few places in California where you can believably be the only Asian in the entire community. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really yeah. smart.
Yeah. So my cousins grew up in Mount Shasta, and we would go every summer to visit them. And Mount Shasta is a very unique setting. And I always like to think of settings as like characters. And I really wanted Izumi to kind of mirror where the same kind of town that I grew up in, which was Beaverton, Oregon, which was mostly white. It was a little bit too close to a big city for Izumi, so that's why I placed her in Mount Shasta. I wanted her to be pretty remote. But yeah, I grew up in a mostly white community that kind of operated off of colorblindness. And so again, her experiences there in Mount Shasta very much mirrored my own growing up.
But I love that you still captured the sense of, because of her, Izumi's Asian girl gang, which is mm-hmm. like, I grew up in San Gabriel, which is, it's full of Asians, but I do relate to the experience of going to like, say, a conference where everyone is white and finding like mm-hmm. the three people of color in the corner
yeah.
and just being friends yeah. with them. I feel like that's like a very yeah. universal experience we all have as minorities in this country.
So
speaking of like the Asian girl gang, I mean, I love that. I didn't really have like an AGG growing up. But I did have friends who, like, it was reminiscence of my friend's chaotic energy. And yeah. I just like love that these girls are just not, they're funny, they're crass, they're you know, they're, you know, chaotic. They don't go by the rules. So I just wanted to ask, like, how did you come up with this group and how was it developing Izumi's relationship with her girlfriends?
Yeah, so I really wanted to create an Asian girl gang is actually something also from my own childhood. I don't know if you're getting this theme here, but a lot of the book is on my own childhood. So I had there were like a few Asians in my middle school and we made this like Asian girl gang and stuff and we thought we were really tough and everything. I wanted to create these friendships that were really fun and really supportive. Like I had considered, like, should the friends fight at some time? Should there be like a wobble in their relationship? But I really wanted like this group of girls to be really consistent and just support Izumi on her journey and where she goes and to veer away from that mean girl trope. But yeah, some of the conversations they had, I had so much fun writing their conversations. And I actually, my editor, like there's a scene where they're in the school library and they're all talking. And I had written probably like 10 or 12 pages of the scene. And my editor very kindly was like, I think we need to cut this by 5 pages because I just put like, it was just all dialogue and conversation. So we ended up having to cut some of it down. But I feel like I kept the heart of it.
Yeah, I mean, that dialogue was a lot of fun. I can imagine, like, and I think it's really great for, like, representation-wise, too, because, you know, you get the stereotype for, like, Asian mm-hmm. people are still kind of quiet, meek, and then you have, like, Nura and Laura just, like, throwing barbs at each other. And mm-hmm. I think their relationship was my favorite in that girl group because they talk the way some of my friends talk to each other.
Yeah. They have a love-hate relationship. I think this got cut from the book, but like they wouldn't get up to get a glass of water for each other, but they would give one another a kidney. Like it's that type of relationship, you know?
So like we talked about like the dialogue and, you know, that was like one of my favorite parts of reading this book. The snarky voice of Izumi. Was Izumi's voice the first thing that came up when you were drafting this book, or did the plot come up first?
So she's what came first, and that's what usually happens with books when I write them, is you start to hear like the character's voice in your head. And Izumi was, I was so lucky because a lot of times with my other books I spend like a whole manuscript like finding the character and like figuring out their arc and then having to go back and reshape it. But with Izumi, she like sprung forth fully formed, like what her journey was going to be. And I just always pictured her with like a great sense of humor and kind of irreverent and plucky in some ways. I was very fortunate that she came out the way that she did.
Yeah, definitely like one of the funnest parts of reading this book. I just love the barbs, references to like pop culture. And it was just like so much fun to read. You said you've never been to Japan before. So I'm curious as to like how you went about your research. Did you go on Google Maps? And did you talk to other people who went to Japan and kind of like wrote down their testimonies, I guess, and weave that into your narrative?
Yeah. So yes to all of that. I have lots of friends and family in Japan that helped me fill in like the detail work, like what color the traffic lights are supposed to be, what sidewalks look like, that kind of thing. And then I also utilized Google Maps. I like traced Izumi's route from the airport to the Imperial Palace and then what that would look like. I had to fill in some details, like the architecture of the personal homes of the Imperial family members isn't public. So I got to have some fun kind of creating what that home might look like. You can narrow in on Google Maps and see like the roof of their houses. So you can kind of try to make like an approximation of like where a garden might be or where, you know, rooms might be situated, you know, based on, you know, where the front is. But I did have to use some creative energy for that. And then a lot of research books. I devoured royal biographies to kind of make sense less of like those details, like the city details and the home details, but more on like what their personal lives look like and what their schedules look like their private lives. That was a little bit trickier.
Yeah, with like the itinerary, I was like, this is quite intense. And I don't know how accurate this is, but, you know, like if I was in Izumi's place, I'd be like, nope. Yeah. I'm one of those people who comes up with a schedule and like halfway through, I'm like, this is not going to happen.
Yeah, I would not hack it as a royal for sure.
Yeah, I read and don't quote me on the actual number, but I read somewhere that the emperor has over 1,500 engagements a year. That's an approximation, but so their lives are really, really rigidly scheduled.
Yeah, with like the Japanese like imperial family, like I thought it was like really interesting on like how the, I guess, succession works and how that is like a really big part of your book, because Izumi's father is the crown prince and, you know, he was a bachelor before. And, you know, there's, I feel like the Japanese imperial family, because they have such a strict rule with succession. So for those who are unfamiliar, it is a patriarchal line and the male heir has to come from the paternal side of the family. So any sons from the maternal side of the family is not eligible for the throne. And I know like recently that's been like quite a debate amongst the Japanese, I guess, imperial household, because the current, the current heir, quote unquote, because she's not really an heir, is Princess Aiko, who is 19 years old. She is the only child of the current Emperor Naruhito. And people have been kind of like wondering, like, should we change the law so that a female can succeed as an heir? So I'm just like curious as to like, was that part of your plan to have, I guess, Izumi be the only child of the crown prince, and how that creates tension amongst like the family and the family dynamics?
Yeah, it very much was purposeful and inspired, as you said, by what's happening right now in Japan with the succession. You know, it's hard because I love Japan, and I think there are lots of wonderful things about it, but this is something that I feel like is wrong about Japan. And, you know, I believe that Japan is one of two countries in the world that has a succession rule like this. The other one, I think, is Saudi Arabia, where only males can inherit the crown. And I do believe that the constitution needs to be ratified to include female successors. But it is a hot topic right now, and I don't know if it will change. I hope it will.
I'm not super familiar with even like, everyone likes to talk about the British monarchy too. I'm like, it's fine.
Yeah.
But it's interesting how it's such an interesting way to like take those like anachronistic concepts and put it into like a modern day story, right? Mm-hmm. Because where else can you get a story set in like 2021 about battles for succession? Yeah. And it's interesting to read, but I was like, I can't believe it actually happens in real life sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it lends itself, I guess, to the story well, because it makes it feel like there's something old world about it, which it very much is. It seems really outdated, but it's really fascinating to me. And also, you know, so surprising, again, especially with how, you know, modern Japan is in other aspects, but with this so traditional.
Well, we talked about the Asian girl gang, but so when my girlfriend was reading this book, she was giving me the play-by-play of like all the shitty things the twins did, the cousins did. And so how, like, did you have a lot of fun writing like the snarky, like snobby dialogue from the royal family side?
Yeah, I did. I love the Shining Twins. So the Shining Twins are twin first cousins of Azumis, who really are like the royal charms in the imperial, the charms in the imperial bracelet. They embody everything that Azumi wants to be and kind of everything that Azumi hates. So she kind of revels and reviles them at the same time. But yeah, they were so much fun to write and to kind of get into, you know, them psychologically. There's a second book that's coming out next year. That's the second book in the series. And the Shining Twins make a reappearance. And I've just enjoyed them, like writing their character arcs and also trying to redeem them a little bit, if that's possible.
If that's possible. I really liked the Shining Twins. They were like some of my favorite characters in the book. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons why I like them so much is because, like you said, they represent all of the traits that Izumi loves and aspires to and also hates at the same time. And it just reminds me of how, like, in Asia, there is so much pressure for women to be, I don't know, I guess, like, perfect, to look perfect, to look slim, to do everything perfectly. And, of course, there's that in American culture as well. But I feel like it is the definition of being, like, the perfect, like, perfect girl is you know, a lot broader here. You can get away with a lot more faults than in Japan, for example. So I guess, like, I just love the fact that Izumi is not the model minority and she's like a subpar student and she's messy. And it's just, you know, the opposite of what a lot of Asian girls aspire to. And and like, I also felt like a lot of the digs that the Shining Twins like threw at Izumi, like with her body, particularly with like, it's like, oh, like that dress, it makes you look slim. And I was just like, oh, I felt that. Like,
I mean, there's a culture clash there for sure, especially because, you know, Izumi is, she is third generation Japanese American. And so really, you know, that kind of pretty imperfect value wasn't instilled in her. In fact, her mom really went the opposite direction with her. And so, so, you know, like I said, the Shining Twins are someone that she kind of yearns to be. She wants to be like a perfect princess, and she mostly because she wants to fit in with Japan. But at the same time, her kind of the way she was raised won't allow her to be that person either.
So like Izumi strives to be the perfect princess, and she's kind of thrown into, I guess, like learning everything about being a Japanese princess the moment she lands in Japan. And she partially wants to be a perfect princess because she wants to bond with her father, Crown Prince Mok. And I actually really like the trajectory of their relationship. I like their first meeting, I was like, wow, this is really awkward, but also really believable. It's just like, what do you say to someone who you've longed to meet for 18 years? And, you know, it's just like you discover that your dad is a prince and there's a lot of protocols. And I thought that relationship was going to be like really rough. I thought like I guess I fell into the stereotype of like, oh, Japanese men, you know, they don't like to show affection, or, you know, they show it in a very different way. It's not like physically affectionate. But I was really surprised that he was so keen for this relationship to work. Yeah. So my question is, like, was that always your plan to have this relationship be I guess warmer than I guess like traditional Japanese male daughter relationships are often portrayed as in media?
Yeah, I mean, there was a definite I wanted to diverge from that a lot. And so some of it is, I mean, fantasy, like the chances of the actual Crown Prince of Japan having like an illegitimate child and then embracing her, that's very complicated and would probably not happen. But since this is in very much, you know, in very many ways, a fairy tale, I wanted their relationship to be warm and understanding and for him to be open to it. He's still, I feel like, a little standoffish sometimes, like they're trying to figure each other out. But really, I wanted the focus of the story to be, you know, Izumi's, you know, journey towards reconciling her Japanese American identity. And I felt like, having kind of her relationship with her dad break down or having any sort of conflict within that, like big conflict, would detract from it. And I really wanted him to propel her forward and really to be a meaningful part of her journey. And I think the only way he could do that was by being warm and receptive and, giving her a boost. Like there's a scene where he helps her find her family history, which I thought was always so sweet and so meaningful for her.
Yeah, I definitely awed at that scene, especially like as someone who, you know, like my family doesn't really talk about our extended family or our family history. I know like bits and pieces. And I think that's an experience that a lot of Asian Americans feel, like we said before, like we know where we come from, but not exactly. And Asia seems to kind of be like a fantasy land.
Yeah.
Well, especially with Izumi's character as like, I guess she's raised as a yonsei, right? Mm-hmm. Because she was raised by her mother, but she's, you know, her father's from the motherland. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as a fourth generation, it's, you're so far removed from that original entry point into the country, right? Like you're essentially as American as you can possibly be, but also because, you know, you still look different, you're not entirely there too. It's a weird place that I don't know, like I can relate to. I know that future generations from my family will probably relate to more.
I didn't know a lot about my family history and it wasn't something that we really talked about. There are little details that were dropped like during my childhood and everything, but for the most part, and especially after World War II, we kind of buried, you know, where we came from, in order to kind of just survive in America in many ways. And so assimilation, and that's also part of, you know, Japanese culture too, is you assimilate to, you know, you try to blend into wherever you go. There's, you know, be harmonious with wherever you are. So just now, like in the last year, my aunt has been sharing all of this writing from my grandmother and my great-grandmother and all these papers, and it's their entire immigration story. And it's really rich. And I can't believe that it's taken this long for us to really see it.
So when I read the book jacket and it said that there was going to be a romance between Izumi, the lost princess, with her stoic bodyguard, I like swooned. I love this. I was like, this is definitely like, I know that it's not possible in real life, but at the same time, it just fueled my girlish fantasies, I guess. So what was it like coming up with Akio's character and just like the development of the romance, because they kind of start off on the wrong foot and Izumi kind of just has a lot of like, it's like, oh, he's really hot, but also like I hate him.
I wish, this is one of the times I'm just going to say, like, honestly, when I decided on the romance, I was like, I love a good hot bodyguard trope. And that's why I decided to run with it. There wasn't like any big, big meaningful thing. I mean, he did become a really meaningful character. And, you know, over time he developed into, this great B storyline for Izumi. But it started off with just like, God, I really like a bodyguard trope. Let's try to make that work.
I respect your decision.
And sometimes it is just as simple as that. And I wanted it to be, again, I love a good like enemies to lovers trope too. There's so much conflict and tension in that. When I go back and I read the story now, I don't know if it was so much enemies, but more opposites, you know, to friends, to lovers. And they really are like, they couldn't be on, you know, further sides of the spectrum, you know, personality wise. Like she's so fun and lively and vibrant, and funny. And, he's so stoic and serious and yeah, and I think that's where their clash came in. So I don't know if it was necessarily that they were enemies, but just complete opposites. So they kind of had to learn more about each other before they could really work together and develop a friendship.
Yeah, they both make some snap judgments right off the bat. But yeah. I like the fact that they do bond over their, I guess, like the commonality that they have is they love their family and yeah. they want to do their best to please their family, to protect their family. And yeah. they go about it in different ways, specifically because of like their personality clashes. Like Akio, he has this expectation to be an Imperial Guard because that is what Imperial staff's families do. It's passed mm-hmm. through the generations. And legacy is kind of like a big thing in Japan and also yes, yeah. East Asia. Mm-hmm. And with like Izumi, like it's something that she kind of has to learn. Like mm-hmm. because America, it's very, you know, it's all about individuality, all yeah. about pursuing your own happiness. And it's mm-hmm. it's kind of like learning a new language in a way. Yeah. Because yeah, it's like different expectations. And I really like that they bond over over their struggles on that. And I think I think it really helped push their relationship to the swoony romantic mm-hmm. territory where Akio like writes poetry. And I was like, yeah. wow, love really makes every single person a poet.
A lot of that is just, you know, wish fulfillment. Like, who wouldn't want a hot bodyguard to write you ancient poetry? But yeah, I think he, you know, they bonded over that, like like you were saying, just the expectations that their families had of them and what felt real and right to them. And for, you know, Izumi, she was kind of moving towards that. She wanted to embrace those expectations and explore them. And he was moving away from that. And it's interesting too, because their paths seem to be kind of diverging, but really it is what brought them together because they were both questioning things at the same time.
I really liked the relationship with Izumi and her mother. Like, I love the fact that like mm-hmm. Izumi's mother like wore these feminist t-shirts that yeah. I really want to have in my real life, and I'm probably going to hunt it down in Etsy. Mm-hmm. But I like the fact that she was a single mother and there isn't the stigma. Like, it's just like, my mom raised me to be proud and yeah. to you know, have pride in my individuality and my independence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, I had a happy childhood. And yeah. that's not something you can really say proudly in East Asia. There's a lot of stigma against single mothers and mm-hmm. A lot of like governmental aggression towards them yeah. as well. Like, they can't get jobs as easily. There's mm-hmm. a lot of stigma. So I really like the fact that you had like this contrast of traditional Japan where mm-hmm. there's a lot of gender norms that you have to conform to. And not to say that like America doesn't have gender norms. It's just mm-hmm. Dealt more differently and the consequences are different. So I just want to say, like, I really appreciated that contrast and Izumi's relationship with her mother. That's not really a question. I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah. I did too. I enjoyed writing, you know, their relationship. It was really sweet and soft and warm. And I think I've been thinking more about like the mom dad romance as I'm drafting like the second book, and about who Hanako, who is Izumi's mom, is. And I just see her as a really independent woman, and you know, and she raised her daughter in a certain way so that, you know, when and if her daughter did find out she was a princess, that she would be equipped for that. I think that was, you know, the mom's intent all along.
So we're winding down to the end of our time. And I just want to ask, I heard that your book was a Reese's book club pick. Mm-hmm. What was your reaction to hearing that news? Because I know that that is like a really big platform. And if you think about how, even though there's been a lot of progress towards having more authors of color be represented in publishing, it's still mm-hmm. like a really rare thing that we see. So that's, you know, like, what was your reaction to it and how has the response been?
Yeah, so my reaction was disbelief. Okay. I think they told me about the book club pick in January and the book came out in May. So I knew about it months in advance. And then they said, well, you can't tell anyone. So I knew about it and then I had to sit on it for a long time. Although I told my husband and I made him read the email to make sure I was reading it correctly. Because I was like, it doesn't say you've been passed on the Reese Book Club. It says you've been chosen, right? Like I had to make sure I wasn't reading wrong. And so it was really exciting and surreal at the same time. And then God, it went so fast. Like the book launched and that was the same time that the news dropped too, that it had been chosen for the book club. You know, the response has been overwhelmingly positive. Again, like I said at the outset of this conversation, it's so scary to put yourself out there and to be vulnerable, especially when, you know, you are working in fiction, but a lot of this material was authentic and was about my whole journey. And I had so many doubts, you know, in the process of writing this, like, should I write this story? You know, do I have a right to write this story? And there was that conflict. And I've had so many, not just Japanese Americans, but Asian Americans reach out to me and say, you know, her journey resonated with me and I saw myself in the pages. And it's really, really amazing.
Yeah. Not to mention the book cover is really beautiful. It's one of those covers you just pass by a bookstore. It's like, I got to pick this up and take a look at it at least.
Yeah, that was one of those things that came together so nicely. I was I expressed to my publisher like the importance of seeing a Japanese American girl on the cover, and they agreed that that was also important to them. And we kind of batted around a few ideas, like should we do, you know, illustrations are kind of really big right now on YA covers, and we considered that. I sent in a list of like all these Japanese things that I like, you know, cultural elements of Japan. And one of them, of course, was origami, and someone mentioned paper cutouts. And then from there, it just kind of snowballed. And we got a really, really beautiful paper cutout cover.
Yeah. So this is the first book of a series. And this is one of the questions that my girlfriend asked me to confirm is that there is a second book.
It is a duology.
It is a duology. Yeah, it was picked up in a two-book contract. And I have finished the second book. It's with my editor right now. So I'm going to start on revisions here soon. But yeah, there will be more Izumi.
Did you write both at the same time, or did you write one first, then start on the second?
I wrote one first, and I actually sold Tokyo Rafter like on a partial. So it wasn't even a full manuscript. It was like 10 chapters of the book. And then it was bought, and I was like terrified because I was like, oh my God, now I have to write this thing. I have to actually write it. So that was slightly terrifying. So it sold like Tokyo Rafter sold like 2 years ago. I think a lot of people are always surprised, like when you sell a book, it doesn't automatically publish. It takes a year or two to in production and everything. And then so right after I finished writing Tokyo after I started the second book, and I turned it in actually the day before Tokyo Ever After published. So I kind of got it by the skin of my teeth. Yeah.
So my question is, you mentioned like going to Japan after the pandemic kind of settles down. Mm-hmm. What is something that you want to do in Japan? Like what are your dream activities? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the better question is like, what is something I don't want to do when I'm in Japan? I want to visit all of the, you know, imperial sites that I wrote about as close as I can get to them, which might actually get me kicked out of Japan if I try to get too close. But I want to see everything. What feels the most important and the most emotional is that we recently found out that there was some land inherited by my dad and his siblings that was passed down according to heritage laws in Japan from his great-grandmother that's in Fukushima. And so we're going to go try to see if we can find that land. So I'm hoping to kind of maybe contact a historian or a registrar and see if we can kind of ferret out that information. But that seems so fun. And also a little bit like a treasure hunt, which is always so exciting too.
That sounds amazing. I haven't done any heritage travel, but it sounds great that you'll have like some purpose in your visit too, in addition to all the fun stuff you'll do.
There's a lot of fun stuff.
There's so much. I mean, yeah, I'm just right now like narrowing down itinerary and how long we want to stay in Tokyo and then where else we want to visit while we're there. And just trying to figure out, you know, where it's not only my dad and I that are going, it's my three siblings. So we're gonna go in heavy.
Well, Emiko, thank you so much for joining us on Books and Boba. It was such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for writing such a great book. And we're all looking forward to the conclusion of Izumi's adventures. Tokyo Ever After is available now at booksellers everywhere. So if listening to us talk has gotten you excited about it, go check it out. But Emiko, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Where can our listeners find you, by the way?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for asking. So I'm on Instagram at Emiko Jean Books, and my website is emikojean.com. It might be emikojeanbooks.com. I'm pretty sure it's emikojean.com. I'm also on Facebook, Emiko Jean Books. So any of those places.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that was our interview with Emiko Jean, the author of Tokyo Ever After, available at bookstores everywhere. Man, I'm looking forward to that second book. I'm glad she turned it in. So that means it's coming out, what, in about a year or two?
In publishing schedule, it would be a year from now. A year. I find it really funny that your girlfriend was just like, hey, so that's mine, right? Like with your with your copy of Tokyo Ever After.
Well, apparently I didn't read the fine print when we defined our relationship, but apparently everything I own belongs to her now.
I mean, that's how relationships work, Marvin.
That was I the only one who was unaware. Don't forget that our July 2021 Books and Boba book club pick is An Ocean of Minutes by Thea Lim. It is a sci-fi novel about time travel and capitalism, and we'll be discussing that book at the end of the month. But until then, thanks again for listening to Books and Boba and our interview with Emiko Jean. We'll see you next time. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Brian, did you go to Saturday school as a kid?
I sure did. Did you?
Totally.
Well, at our podcast, Saturday School, we don't teach a language, but we pass along the culture that we do know.
And that's Asian American pop culture.
Ada is a journalist, and I'm a professor and film festival programmer.
We've watched a lot of great Asian American movies, and we want you to watch them too. Come listen to us as we look back at the pioneering films that have led us to today.